Welcome to Parents' Perspective. So how was your day? 16-year-old Dave's mom called from the kitchen when she heard his keys jangling in the hall. He responded, heading for his room. A few minutes later, Dave was in the kitchen. Anything new go on at school? His mom tried again. Came the response from inside the open refrigerator. How was the chem test? And then the crunching sound of a fresh apple being chomped. Dinner's at 7 tonight. You'll be home, right? I'm going to Tim's for a while. See you later. On your way out, could you please take the garbage? She began, but before she could finish, the back door slammed shut. Well, she thought to herself, he does know how to speak in full sentences. From a parent's perspective, how can we connect successfully with our teenagers? I'm Sandy Burke.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is one of the country's leading authorities on parenting teenagers. Dr. Michael Riera hosts his own syndicated radio program, Family Talk with Dr. Mike, and is the parenting correspondent for the CBS Saturday Early Show as well. He worked as a school counselor, teacher, and dean of students over a period of 19 years, and has been a guest speaker for parenting groups, universities, medical schools, and many other kinds of educational institutions. Dr. Riera lives in Northern California with his wife and two children. Welcome to Parents Perspective.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, teenagers, why is it especially important to maintain a connection with your child during the teenage years?
Well, in psychology, we have this phrase called separation, with the idea being that we need to separate from our parents to become fully individuated adults, to have independence, autonomy, and identity. And I think that's actually very fearful for most kids. What they need to do is they need to move away from us, but I call it more of extending away. And while they're extending away, we need to keep that connection alive and viable, because if they encounter trouble along the way, they need to still be connected so they can pull back to us. And this is where they can lick their wounds. This is where they can heal. This is where they can develop more depth, then go back into the world. So I think the connection is very important. And I also think parents know intuitively that this connection is very important. And all the difficult stuff of parenting a teenager, having guidelines, having limits, having consequences, all that stuff that's no fun, but we know we have to do, becomes much more effective when we're connected to them.
Why exactly are those years typically adversarial, that we always sort of, we take a deep breath and go, oh boy, here we go?
Well, in part, it's not that they're adversarial. It's we expect more of the first 10 or 12 years to continue through adolescence. So what works so well when they're 7 and 8 and was wonderful now no longer doesn't work, but it also backfires and makes things worse, because what's happened is the relationship has changed. And as parents, we need to get ahead of the curve and understand how that relationship changes. So the metaphor I always employ is that when your child is born, you're the manager of their life. You organize their life. You ask them questions, direct questions. They give you direct answers. When your 7-year-old, contrary to the story you read at the beginning of the show, Sandy, comes home after school and you say, how was your day? Magic happens, because they tell you. You know, they tell you about what happened on the playground, who had what for lunch, and all you have to do as a parent is every once in a while go, But all of a sudden, as a teenager, that changes, because following the manager metaphor, what they do when they hit adolescence is they fire us as the manager. And they basically say, good job, Mom, good job, Dad, but I'll take it from here. And this is scary for parents, because the horizon of adolescence, of drugs, alcohol, cars, sex, future, it's very scary, and this is when we want to have maximum amount of influence, not minimum amount. So what I think the parents need to do is, instead of insisting to stay the manager, which is always a power struggle and it's always a fight and it will exhaust both of you, or instead of giving up, you know, and saying, okay, take care of your life, and we have both kids in schools, the micromanaged and the abandoned, you shift. You shift more to the side and you become the consultant. And that's what they want. They want their parents at their, actually, they probably want you at the side and back two steps. But they want you always within view, so that if they need something, they can turn towards you. And the challenge is figuring out how to keep that connection going and keeping it vibrant where you have a lot of influence on your kids. No, you don't have control, but you've got influence over the big decisions.
When you're a consultant, other kinds of consultants, the person who wants your advice asks for it.
Right.
Do we wait?
That's a great question. No one's ever asked me that before, so that was terrific. No, you don't wait. Instead, what you do is, I call it being strategic. Another radio host I interviewed with called it being sneaky. Whichever S word works for you, sneaky or strategic, it means, and this is a large part of what the book is about, understanding developmentally what's going on with the kids so that we can make use of this to connect with them. So an example is late at night. This is the time when we can connect with our kids because they have a different sleep pattern first than we do, and there's biological, physiological reasons for this. They stay up later. But every once in a while, it's worth it on a Thursday night when you go to bed at 9:30 and you wake up at 11 to go to the bathroom and you see the light on in their room, that you go in and say, you know, Jason, time to get to bed. And then you wait for him to brush his teeth. And then as he crawls into bed, you turn the light off and you linger in the hallway, just between the doorway and the hallway for a moment. And now you ask him the questions that you asked him after school. You know, how was soccer practice that he had no answers for? Now, all of a sudden, he'll open up. He'll have things to say. The only difficult part for a parent is you're stuck in that place of standing there. Because if you go sit down on the bed, you know it'll ruin it. It's too close. But you can't walk away either. But you just stand there for about 15 minutes. Don't ask a lot of questions. Don't give a lot of advice. Just let it unfold because this is when they're going to ask the questions. This is when they're going to seek out your advice. But we have to put ourselves in the place at the right time.
Well, speaking of putting in the place at the right time, in terms of acting as a consultant, what about the hard questions where you really do want to say, gee, this is really a limit? For example, when the kid is going to go to a party and he really doesn't want your consultation about there should be an adult around and all that kind of stuff. How do you work that?
And he doesn't want you calling the parents before he goes to the party.
Well, I mean, if it's important to understand. It's a good question because it helps me illuminate something else, which is being the consultant is not mean an abdication of authority, and it doesn't mean an abdication of responsibility. And it means that we are our kids' parents first. We're not their friends. I mean, a big mistake this generation is making is trying to be friends with our kids, and that just does not work. They have plenty of friends. They don't need any more. They need a mom and a dad. That's a very special relationship. So what this means is, and as a consultant, you consult on most things, but there's a few that you're going to weigh in on heavily, and these are the important ones. And sure, no teenager wants you to call the parents who's hosting the party, but that's our responsibility. That's our form of peer pressure, is calling up and saying, you know, my son says there's a party at your house tonight, and you know, first you want to make sure that the other parent knows there's a party at their house, and then just want to make sure you're going to be there, and they'll say, yes, I'm going to be there. Then we have to ask another level of questions. It just doesn't stop there, because there are more and more parents, and I don't want to frighten listeners, but it's a reality, that will let kids come to their home, have a party, and let the kids drink there. And they will confiscate keys and just, they'll sort of put themselves in charge of safety. So as a parent, you have to ask another level question. Well, I know you're going to be there. Is there going to be alcohol there? And the parent might say, no, we're not going to serve any alcohol. Good, I'm glad to hear that. What will you do if you find someone with alcohol? Well, I hadn't thought about that. Well, I'll tell you what, if you find my son involved with alcohol, please call me. Here's my number. And so we have to go a little bit further with that. And with our kids, I mean, I think this is where we have to stand up for what we believe in. And they're going to a party, and it's always worthwhile to remind them, remember the rules around here? No drinking alcohol. If we catch you, there's going to be consequences. At the same time, if something happens and you get over your head and you make some bad decisions, call me. We'll come get you. We want you to get home safely. The next day, we'll deal with the issues. We'll be proud that, you know, you took responsibility in this, but there will be consequences. And I think, you know, that's the short conversation when they're getting ready to go out the door. The longer conversation that we all have to have with our kids is, why? Why do we not want them to engage in whatever behavior it is, whether it's early sex, whether it's drinking, whether it's drugs? We have to have our own thought-out reasons. And alcohol, yes, is against the law, but that's not enough. That's not enough for most kids to hang their hat on. It's got to be more reasons. It may be that it affects their brain development. It becomes a coping mechanism, and they fall back on it to solve their problems. It becomes a way, a social lubricant. They count on this to be able to meet people. It could become it's a way of escaping stress, and that's how they try to solve their problems. It could be that there's a genetic predisposition in our family, and they need to understand their friends can use a lot and never get in trouble, but they use 3 or 4 times, and they're going to really be in trouble in a hurry. So every family, it's different, but as parents, we need to really make this a personal conversation with our kids.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on staying connected to your teenager.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Mike Riera, author of Staying Connected to Your Teenager.
I think another issue that goes along with that is the smoking issue, where they don't see the parents smoking, most likely, but their friends, it's kind of cool. Some of the cool kids are smoking, and I can stop anytime I want to, so I'll try it.
Yeah, and that's a fallacy, and it's one that I think we need to puncture with our kids, because when you talk to the smoking experts, the smoking cessation experts, not the smoking experts.
They can quit anytime, yeah. Lots of times.
They all say that the most difficult age to quit smoking is during adolescence. Mm. Harry Stack Sullivan, the great American psychiatrist, once said, once you hit puberty, the strongest organizer of behavior is the avoidance of loneliness. That they need to be with people. They need to have acceptance. And cigarette smoking is the perfect way to get that for yourself. Because if you think about it, if you guys are at school and I'm a little lonely and you guys are best friends and you're smokers, this means you go off campus, you sneak away to smoke somewhere. Maybe you go to the library steps. If I smoke, then you're very apt as you're walking off campus to say, hey, Mike, you want to come with us? I walk with you. I've got companionship as we walk there. We smoke the cigarette together. It's a shared ritual. We know that the chemicals in the cigarette amp kids up a little, give them a little bit more energy so that they're a little bit more vocal, the little more talkative kind of thing. So I have a good time with you. Then we walk back to school. I've been with you for 15 minutes. I've got a connection to people, and all it's cost me is just smoking a cigarette. So, of course, I'm going to say to myself, I could quit any time. I'm really with you for the companionship. It's not because of the cigarette, though later on, once I get hooked, it's because of the cigarette.
Scary, isn't it?
It is.
In terms of parents connecting with their kids, what kinds of examples would you give? So now, of course, parents are all frazzled and living, smoking, drugs. Can we find little ways to sort of connect?
Well, the first thing to understand is no matter what your kid sounds like and the looks they give you, they want to connect with you. Mm-hmm. They want a good relationship with you. They won't tell you that. It's hard for them. That's way too vulnerable. But we have to understand they want it. And they will help us out when we put ourselves in the right place in the right time. So the first thing that comes to mind for me is quintessential moment every single day with kids is driving in the car. This is when your kids will open up to you. You know, sitting next to you, they're just looking out and they'll sort of free associate about things and they'll have conversations that they would never have elsewhere. Almost always in transition are times that kids will open up. In the car, it's even better if their friends are in the car with them and their friends are hanging out in the back seat and your son or daughter's probably in the back seat with them. And probably 3 minutes into the ride, someone will say something, a comment that will grate against you, and it's the kind of comment that starts at the top of your spine and works all the way down the base of your spine and gives you a little chill, and you have about 2 seconds to decide, am I going to say something about this or am I going to let it go? Fortunately, about 90% of the time you can let it go, and you let it go, and then what they will do is they will act as if you're not there. They will talk about all the things that are going on, what's really happening at the parties, who's got a crush on who, what the English teacher is really saying. You get the dirt on everything. And then when your son comes back up and sits next to you, what's very important is that you don't ask him a lot of questions about it. You were listening. He knows you heard this. He knows you have the background. And if you can discipline yourself not to go into 20 questions with him, eventually, maybe that ride, maybe 6 months down the road, he'll lean forward a second time, turn the radio volume down, and begin to tell you more of what was going on. But now the key is he's setting the agenda. It's just like the consultant. The client is setting the agenda, and now he'll tell you what he wants to tell you.
We always hear about the dinner hour, how important having dinner together as a family is. And then, of course, we know the soccer coaches who call practice for 6, mm-hmm. and so forth, all the different kinds of activities. How can the dinner hour be useful?
Well, the dinner hour is very useful, but in a very different way, because remember when the kids are 8 and 9, dinner was a fantastic time. And they would open up and they would tell you things and you would create stories together. It could be a magical time. With a teenager, first of all, you need to understand, I think the average length of dinner with a teenager and their family is 11 minutes. So there's not a lot of earth-shattering information that's going to get shared there. Instead, dinner time is the time to create a bridge between you and your child so that it's not the big information, it's the mundane, it's looking them in the eye, it's making eye contact, it's telling them to remember to sit up straight, these kinds of things which create the bridge so that when the bigger issues come up, they can cross the bridge. Because, again, research has shown when you ask kids before the age of 12 if they have a problem, who their go-to with the problem, First on the list is parents, second are teachers, third are friends. Once they hit adolescence, the list reverses itself. So we go from top to bottom, which means we need to create the bridge for them to cross over. The one exception to dinner, the one time that dinner will lead to big conversations, and this is, it's a special occasion, is when you take your kids out to a fancy dinner. Take them out to a fancy restaurant. When there's plenty of time, get them dressed up, let them put their suit on or their nice dress, take them to a nice dinner, take your time at dinner. What this is it's out of their comfort zone. And they will become so focused on all, mostly around them are other adults. They'll see three forks on their left-hand side. They're not sure what to do with it. You can discreetly say, you know, just start on the outside, work your way in. Say it's your son, he'll have his best manners, and he'll be hyper-conscious of it. He will start to grow into being this adult with other adults around. Then, after he's successfully navigated the dinner, dessert is coming, or on the ride home, he will let go of all of his defenses. You know, he's like, I did it. You know, I made it through that. And now he'll be able to talk to you and begin to talk to you about a lot of things that are happening at school with his friends that he wouldn't talk about in another situation. And so taking him a little bit out of his comfort zone, stretching that with dinner, connecting over dinner, and then reaping the rewards on the way home is a common way for kids to open up and a way for parents to stay connected with their kids.
So in addition to saving up for college tuition, we have to save up.
Yep, you have to save up. And it's a beautiful thing to do. I mean, I'm a big fan of you take a kid out to dinner after a semester, and it's not because they got good grades. It's not because they did well in the sports team or got the lead in the play. It's because they hung in there. They got through another semester. It's a lot of work. It's a time that builds in reflection. And I know families that have done this over the years. It just becomes a natural time for reflection. I know a family that did it from kindergarten through 12th grade, and they would take each daughter one at a time out to dinner. They had three daughters, so it was expensive at the end of the year for them. And they would take them out, and the daughters would just naturally reflect and then reflect on earlier years. You know, remember when I was in third grade and you took me out and I spilled that all over me, and the sophomore would say now. So there creates a sense of history and shared history, which is real important to the connection also.
Sounds like from this we might also talk about rituals, family rituals that are significant, because teenagers would be the first to vocalize, oh, we don't have to, I don't want to do that again, are you kidding?
Yeah, they'll say, I don't want to do that again, are you kidding? But whatever that is, if you don't do it, they'll be upset. You know, it might be during the holidays, New Year's, you have a traditional dinner and people come over and everything like this. And one year you decide not to do it, and they'll be really, why aren't you doing it? You know, what's wrong? What's wrong with the world kind of thing? So the rituals, whatever we have, and you know, sometimes you hear families say, we don't have rituals. We really don't have many rituals in our family. We just have a few. You know, there aren't a lot of rituals in our country. And I really disagree. And every family I know, I remember talking with many families that say they don't have rituals. After 30-minute conversation, they discover they've got a lot of rituals. There's certain ways they do things, like the family dinner before everyone goes to school for the new year, the summer vacation they take together, camping somewhere. We all have these rituals, and we need to look at them. And actually, I think the way you discover your rituals is really simple. Ask your kids. Ask your kids what they are, and they're the ones that pay attention to them, and they will respond to them. And yes, I think kids will roll their eyes, go, not again. And you want to work with them. You don't insist that the way it was done from the day they were born to now when they're 16 is the way it's always going to be. But, you know, maybe it's the Christmas Eve dinner that the relatives have come over every year to your house for the last 16 years, that you say to your 16-year-old son, okay, we're going to have the dinner. We're still going to have it. Do you want to modify it in any way? Do you want to make any changes? What do you want to do to, so that they can impact it, but the ritual doesn't go away? Because these rituals, I call them memory mirrors, that during these rituals, you remember that time every year. So that the big holidays, a birthday, what's so powerful about that is we remember what happened on those days. Whereas a normal Tuesday or Thursday in March, you wouldn't remember what happened. But if it's your birthday, you remember that. And as a family, those rituals are powerful because we can look back in time with one another. And for teenagers who live so much in the present and the future, it's a great way to get them to look back.
And it sounds like if you ask them to modify whatever the ritual is, it gives them some ownership in the process, which they didn't feel when they were younger.
Absolutely. And you want them to have ownership. It won't be quite the ritual you imagined, but it'll probably be a better one for the whole family.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on staying connected to your teenager.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Michael Riera, author of Staying Connected to Your Teenager, How to Keep Them Talking to You, and How to Hear What They're Really Saying.
How is parenting a boy different than parenting a girl with the teen years?
You sort of picked the question that I went into hesitantly in the book, is talking about the difference between the genders, because you guys know me. I'm not a big believer in the stereotypes. You know your own kids best, and you're going to sort of put on what works for them. But in general, boys have more of a push towards independence. And as a result, they're more focused on that. Their connections with their parents will often come through doing things together. So, you know, doing a chore together, shooting baskets together, going for a walk together, focused on problem solving, how to move forward with things. Then they'll open up about the other things. Girls tend to be more focused on the connection. Moms and daughters have the most sparks fly in that relationship. And what's amazing to men is the sparks can fly in such a heated way, and then an hour later they can have their arms around each other and be best buddies again. You know, men sort of wonder, how did that happen? Because it's about the emotion of it. It's about the relationship, and they want to make sure the relationship is secure before they do other things. And what ends up happening is dads with their daughters need to modify their style, and moms with their sons need to modify their style. And the biggest relationship that suffers the most during adolescence are daughters and fathers. And there is a big drop in the level of closeness that they feel towards one another when they hit adolescence. And I think there are two reasons for this. One is men tend to be more physical. And with their daughters, they're physical when they're young. They're in their laps. They're hugging them. They're scooping them up. And little girls love this. But then all of a sudden their daughters hit puberty and they start to see these are young women. They notice the way other people are looking at their daughter and they withdraw because they're not sure how to touch their daughter in an appropriate way. And the daughter has the feeling of, dad's just left me. He's abandoned me. And then you add on top of it that dads tend to focus on solving problems rather than the emotional connection. So I did a piece on the news recently about this, and someone came up afterwards and they told me a story, which is in the book, which just sums it up. As he said, his daughter came home in tears, and his 14-year-old daughter was in tears after school, and he said, "You okay, honey?" And she said, "No, I'm not okay. I'm crying. Can't you tell? I'm not okay." And he said, "What happened?" She told him a story about her friends making fun of her and pushing her out of the group. And what he immediately did is what most men did. He tried to solve the problem. You know, well, could you say something to this one? Could you do here? Then he added the killer question. Is there any grain of truth in what they're saying to one another? At which point the daughter said, "I'm out," and she ran upstairs in tears. And just then the mom came home. She said, "What's going on?" And he gave her a quick thumbnail. She said, "Well, I'm going to go talk to her." And he said, "I wouldn't. You know, she's on the warpath. I wouldn't. Be careful." But the mom went up. Father waited in the hall because he was expecting the mom to come right out. He waited 45 minutes. Nothing happened. He went downstairs. Hour later, the mother and the daughter come down, arms around each other, tears in both their eyes, and the father watches as they get a bowl of ice cream together, and then the daughter goes, "Okay, Mom, I'm going to go back to my room. Thanks a lot. You helped a lot." And the mom said, "Anytime, honey." Went away. Dad turned to her and said, "What happened? What did you do?" And she said, "Really, honey, when she told me the story, all I turned to her and said is, that must feel awful. You must feel so bad about that." And he said, "What?" And she said, "Yeah." And then she opened up and we had all that. She cried and it was sad. And then we figured out what to do. But I just connected with her emotionally first.
And we've got to tell you, as people who have been married for many years, each of us, this is a definite male-female.
It is.
Dichotomy.
And it's where moms are so important to sons, because they help them explore that emotional landscape, which is so important for sons to do, to explore that emotional landscape and still stay masculine. You know, it's not about making them more feminine. It's about staying masculine and exploring this part of themselves.
Dr. Riera, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue this topic further and who are frantic?
Well, I think there are a couple of different kinds of resources. In the back of the book, there are some books that I recommend. But I would also go, there's some interesting websites out there. One is called diaryproject.com. And it's a very interesting website because it's for teenagers, and it's anonymous diary entries they make on a variety of topics. And what it allows is other people to comment on their diary entries, to give them support, to give them some advice. And what it's wonderful for is you can go into that and you can read the diary entries. If you have a 14-year-old, you get a sense of what's going on in 14-year-olds' lives. Mm-hmm. Just understand, my only caveat would be when you go to something like that, I think you have to remember their diary entries. So people exaggerate things and they're just sort of venting sometimes. The other website that I would mention is Parent Soup. I think it's a great website, parentsoup.com. And it's a website devoted to parenting. And they have lots of different people, lots of different articles, lots of different message rooms where people can go into chat rooms and talk with one another about the real issues of parenting. Sort of, you know, take your gloves off, you know, what are the difficult topics? How do you handle them? How do other people handle them? Because I think we all as parents have more to learn from other parents because, you know, what you do in your house, Linda, and what you do in your house, Sandy, may be different from what I do. And I may learn from you not to do exactly what you're doing, but it sparks the creativity in me to see, oh, here's another way of doing something, which I think is what parenting's all about.
That's the one job we're never trained to do.
Right.
Well, you have been helping us get through a lot
of battles. It's always wonderful to talk to you guys. You ask such good questions.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Dr. Riera's new book, Staying Connected to Your Teenager. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show 185. Tell us what station you're listening to if you can. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective and our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.